Hello and welcome to Take Five. I am your host, Jeff Ventura, the Vice President of Communications at CRN. Today, we are breaking down and unpacking an issue for you all, a CRN's response to the FTC updated substantiation guidance. I know that's a mouthful, but we'll make it as simple as we can for you. To help me do that, we are joined today by Megan Olson. She's our SVP and General Counsel at CRN, and by Katie Bond. She's the partner partner, at Keller and Heckman. Thank you both of you for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time. This is a complicated one, and we're really looking to kind of look under the hood here and get at this issue. I think one of the things that we really want to know about this particular guidance and the CRN response is, what is it exactly that FTC, in your estimation, is trying to fix with this guidance? Megan, can you help clarify that?
Sure. So I think, interestingly, industry and those like Katie Bond, who do quite a bit of work around substantiation legal principles, I think we're all likely to say the guidance wasn't broken. We appreciate clarification from the agencies that regulate the supplement industry as to what they're thinking about how various statutes are applied. But what we've really, at least the concern CRN had over the years, as the FTC trying to make substantiation standard for dietary supplement claims more rigid and been rebuffed by the courts, correctly rebuffed, because the point of the substantiation standard and the way in which dietary supplements are separate, dietary supplements and food are a separate legal category from drugs, for example, with different requirements for the claims we can make, how we go through the FDA regulatory process. It's all about flexibility and looking at the type of claim being made and ensuring then that the substantiation meets it. So a big concern that we saw with this guidance, and one of the reasons we decided that CRN needed to act to push a conversation with FTC, is their heavy reliance on statements that suggest bright line requirements for randomized clinical trials. And there is definitely a place in the substantiation kind of regime for those types of studies. But you really need to look at the type of claim being made and determine the best way then to go about having flexibility for the guidance. And that is definitely borne out in the law. Its courts have supported that for 20 plus years, since not only DSHEA was enacted, but the guidance was first put out in 1998. And we've heard the FTC continue to kind of talk about this flexibility when we've staff comments, for example, from a FTC staff attorney that joined us in New York City at our legal conference. They recognize there should be flexibility, but they don't really say it in the guidance. So that was just, I think, a lot of the impetus for why we felt this was really, really necessary to write this petition. And we're really hoping that it will give the staff and the leadership at FTC a lot to think about and spur additional conversations moving forward.
Katie, I see you nodding your head. Echoing that?
Totally. Yeah.
Well, let's get right to another question that we've got. So, when we're talking about, you mentioned bright line, and so when we're talking about this bright line requirement, help me understand and help our listeners understand. They're not saying you're not saying that there, you know, no substantiation is required. I mean, in this is a case where there is a need for some changes. I mean, so I think, you know, you're talking about kind of having a dialogue or having a real conversation with FTC about this. Are you advocating for things to remain as they are, or is there a little bit of sort of wiggle room there, that, you know, a little bit of admitting that maybe there is some area of opportunity in terms of change?
Yeah, so I think, so how this has all come about is around 2009, the FTC decided that and the guidance that Megan talked about is from 1998. That's the original mm-hmm. guidance that we believe is not broken and didn't need necessarily this update. And so in 2009, the FTC first made this push to try, and they said be more specific, but what they were doing is pushing clinical trial standards. So saying any kind of dietary supplement claim is going to need a clinical study. they've won on that with disease claims. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, the courts agreed. So we agree, that's fine for disease claims. But when they tried to push the same kind of very rigid clinical trial standard that you have to be testing the full product, all this kind of stuff, onto structure function claims for dietary supplements, the courts on three different occasions in big cases didn't go along with it. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, I think the guidance, you know, it's helpful in that it lays out what they think is a perfect clinical study. And if ever you have a claim that might need a clinical study, that's helpful. But the issue that we have is that the guidance seems to suggest that any health-related claim, and health-related claim isn't even a term that's used in like the FDCA and the food and drug context. So it's hard to know, like, do you really mean any type of claim that might touch on health? Like, that's a little extraordinary that then you might mean like supports the nervous system, might need a clinical. Like that's the part that I think really was concerning to CRN,
right. Right.
And to
right.
defense lawyers.
Right, absolutely. So product testing versus ingredient testing. Why is this important?
So I can jump in and talk about that issue a little bit. The FTC, National Advertising Division, which is a self-regulatory body, has a lot of precedent around how to support, I'll call it health-related claims, not a defined term, but kind of gets at the structure function, well-being, nutritional support claims that are permitted for supplements. They've all long supported ingredient testing in the right context. If you're talking about, you know, vitamin C supports the immune system and you have a multivitamin product, you don't need to necessarily go test that exact combination of all of the ingredients every single time. And it allows companies, the industry, information to consumers to be provided in a way that isn't going to be overly cumbersome and expensive. You don't have the same types of ability to charge or the same type of monopoly type exclusivity around these products like you would for a drug product, for example. And so cost is a factor. And that's not to say that the level and the type of support that they're using isn't going to be sufficient. It's that it's absolutely fine to test on ingredients if you're looking at your product and doing the other work to ensure that the rest of your ingredients aren't going to interfere with how you've tested a particular ingredient. Are the amounts the same, the form? And back to kind of Katie's point that the FTC does give some very good guidance and examples around how you might do a clinical trial or how you might go about looking at whether testing for one ingredient or one product is relevant to another product. And we fully support that. We just don't, again, there was some very broad statements in the updated guidance that tried to suggest not only do you need RCTs, but you need product level RCTs. That's never been the standard. It's not the standard that I think the creators of Deche envisioned. These are products that certainly, if you are framing your claim correctly, if you're ensuring that there's nothing that interferes, you can test the ingredient. And one of the examples, I think I'll attribute this to Katie. I think she's kind of pointed this out, especially now, but throughout the years, companies aren't likely to be formulating products where the ingredients are going to interfere. And I think on a basic example, you know, level, an example is you want a product for sleep support. So you put in things like melatonin, maybe you put some other products that are tested to have soothing and relaxing properties. You're not going to add caffeine to that.
Chamomile product. Or something like that.
Exactly. Exactly. You're not going to go and add something. Oh, let's throw some caffeine in. Even if for some reason there was, okay, it might have a synergistic effect on the melatonin, but then it, you know, goes the opposite direction and keeps you awake. That's maybe an extreme example, but this is really what companies are doing when they're formulating these products, when the scientists are formulating the R&D staff. They're not looking to throw a bunch of product ingredients in. They're going to counteract efficacy.
What about this? I noticed in the guidance, in your letter, this notion of who's qualified to provide substantiation, that's also sort of in play. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I can jump in, or like I'll, yeah. Katie.
Or Katie?
can just throw kind of out there our initial thoughts. And I know Katie definitely expanded on this quite a bit in our petition, but we don't. So again, flexibility, we're going back to flexibility. And I should probably say we haven't really started this conversation talking about the standard that FTC uses, which is called competent and reliable scientific evidence. That is meant to be a flexible standard. It talks about experts. I think the old language talked about experts in the field. And so for supplements, a lot of times that would be like a PhD in nutrition, someone with a scientific background in nutrition versus, let's say we're talking about heart health. So a PhD in nutrition versus a cardiologist. And actually, I think the PhD in nutrition is likely to know more about how it affects your body versus the cardiologist, which is going to be concerned with, you know, surgery, damage, those types of things. And so with flexibility, we were concerned that FTC suggested that the expert had to be an expert in the given condition, which is a disease. It signals a disease. And if we're not talking about diseases, if we're not talking about it's going to reduce your cholesterol by a certain amount or reduce your risk of a cardiovascular event, we're not, I think, looking then to have that person that's the expert in the condition, because it's not a condition, it's general health. And I'll let Katie jump in as well.
Yeah, no, completely agree. I mean, it's about maintaining health. And just a funny little personal anecdote, when I was working on this petition, and one of the claims that we put forth is like magnesium supports the nervous system and does some other supportive things in the body. And for that kind of claim, there's really not, it didn't start with RCTs. It built from wildly different types of case studies and epidemiological studies and all that kind of stuff. But also I learned along the way, like who might be at risk and who, and basically that magnesium might be like people who get migraines might not be getting magnesium and may need a little, even a little more than the average. And so I mentioned that to my husband who gets migraines, and I was like, you really should talk to your doctor about this. And he's like, so he can say he's never heard of it and move on and prescribe me something. I'm like, right. You know, that's true. Like on the ground level, we've all gone to doctors and they aren't, you know, nutrition isn't a big part of the curriculum at this point for being a medical doctor. And so really nutritionists and dietitians and those folks play a vital role for, you know, putting forth nutrition as wellness, nutrition as, you know, yeah.
Yeah. And I love that, because the idea here with the flexibility and what we want it to impart to FTC, this is about health and well-being. It's not about treating a disease. When you're treating a disease, you're going down a different route. You're looking at different types of evidence, and it should be a different level, a more exact specific evidence. I want to know that cause and effect, that yes, it actually is going to lower my cholesterol. So,
and it kind of gets to my next question, which is about, you know, sort of where does the conversation become constructive? Because, you know, you had mentioned that you had a dialogue with someone from FTC at the legal conference. And it seems like, you know, the door is not shut by any means in terms of the dialogue here about how to make this guidance sort of better. Talk a little bit about that. Where do you think there's fertile ground for agreement?
Yeah, so I'll jump in if that works.
Sure, yeah.
So I think we're really hoping that there is an opening. I mean, we do think we had a healthy, good dialogue at the CRN conference. This has been an FTC that Megan has made the point that is really pushing open meetings, transparency. And we think, you know, we're not coming in saying like, do this or we'll sue you. Like, we really do want to have a conversation, because we think it's not necessarily well known. We're so used to in this country the drug model of research. And even when we're talking about the vaccines, it's talking about RCTs and that kind of thing. And I think a lot of folks aren't aware of the kind of really unusual types of research that went into figuring out what are essential nutrients for good health. And again, it came from like case studies. It came from, you know, different animal models and that kind of thing.
It's still science. It's just a different model. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. bottom line here, and thank you both for your time. We really appreciate it. The bottom line here, I mean, what is the takeaway for member companies? They look at this and they see this sort of stringency being applied in this guidance. It may make them flinch, it's sort of overwhelming. What is the bottom line you'd like to give them as a takeaway in terms of where we are at now? With regard to this response to this particular updated guidance,
I can jump in quickly, and definitely, Katie, welcome your thoughts as well from the perspective of you work with so many companies on advising on claims, etc. I'll make a plug for one of our resources for members, which is the we did a substantiation webinar that Katie was on earlier this year, and we. You know, one of the things that companies need to remember is this is guidance. It's not the law. It's not court precedent. So when you're looking at substantiation, that's what still is going to govern. There's a great line in the petition that talks about the fact that just because the FTC, wants this to be the standard or is suggesting it's the standard, it doesn't mean that they can make it the standard. It's the FTC can no more change court precedent through guidance then they can convert CARS from a factual standard to a legal requirement for RCTs. So the law says there's flexibility. Courts have said there's flexibility. Keep that in mind. And I think that's why this petition is so important, not only to educate the FTC, but so that companies can see what the court precedent is, how DSHEA was enacted, and what it means. And we know that litigation, class action litigation risks continue to be a big concern for the dietary supplement and food industry. And so I think there could be help there as well, that we've kind of laid out, here's what the guidance is actually saying. And hey, FTC, we'd appreciate that, now that we've viewed it through that lens, that the guidance is fine-tuned to go that direction. And I think, another kind of, if we do have the opportunity to talk with FTC, the idea that we welcome dialogue so that companies who are trying to support structure, function, well-being claims have an idea what the FTC expects. But if it's too rigid, if you have so many disease examples that don't apply to the claims we can make, it's not going to be helpful for companies that are following the law and not making disease claims.
Megan Olson, Katie Bond, want to thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Our viewers and our members of CRN, of course, owe you a debt of gratitude for such insight and the breakdown of such a complicated issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.